This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters.
I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
This week, I'm joined by a guest who probably doesn't even realise that she was instrumental in the creation of this second season where we interview doctors, Dr. Jacintha Kira. We met through the conventional method of sliding into the DMs, and today is our first time meeting in real life. Jacintha kindly messaged Suba and I during our first season and shared her experiences of her FY1 year, where she suffered the losses of 2 close family members. Jacintha is an anaesthetic trainee and is passionate about making the conversations around organ donation, death, and grief less taboo. Hello, Jacintha.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm trying to get the sexy Suba voice, but it's not really happening.
I've literally been trying since March, and yeah. It's so sad.
Well, I'm glad that someone else has a high voice as well, so we can bounce off each other.
I feel like we're going to have to like set the tone of this conversation like lower somehow. So, Jacintha, thank you so much for coming here today.
That's okay. That's all right. Thank you so much for that introduction. It's really embarrassing, but no, I think you've managed to sum up what I feel really well, so thank you.
Good. So it's actually quite funny because, so as I said, when I met Jacintha this morning, because I haven't met her in real life, I thought I knew what she looked like, and I was quite sure of it. I was like, okay, look, I'm looking for this like cute, poppin' little brown doctor. I was like, she's gonna be dressed well, she's gonna be dressed in gym gear because she like goes to the gym all the time on her Instagram. And then like, so I walk up to grab my coffee this morning, and then there's this girl, she's Asian-ish. To be honest, she doesn't even look Asian when I look back at her now. And I was like, hey, Jacintha. And this woman just gave me the weirdest look.
I bet she was like a little Chinese lady, isn't she? Thanks, Amelie.
Like I got the wrong side.
I know.
So yeah, then Jacintha texted me. She was like, I'm getting coffee. And I was like, no, you're not.
Oh, and I saw her this morning. Don't worry.
So nice to meet you properly.
Yeah, thanks. I feel like I know you. It's really weird.
Probably because we've been talking for the past half an hour. So, Jacintha, we're here to talk about death.
Mm.
And you're teaching me to speak clearer about the words death rather using lost and pass away a little bit more.
Mm.
So do you mind just starting with telling me why you messaged us in the first place? And then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, sure. So unfortunately, I experienced death when I was an F1 and an F2. So within an 11-month period, my brother-in-law, Tej, was in a really severe, like, freak car accident where he ended up having a 6-month intensive care stay. And that was just when I qualified as a doctor. So dealing with that was really difficult.
No, of course.
And then, you know, when I thought I was kind of over that, my dad then died suddenly, just out of the blue. And it's something that I feel our personal losses and our personal bereavements, they aren't spoken about.
Mm-mm.
I felt a bit embarrassed and a bit ashamed. And it's something that if I can just share my story and share that it's okay to not be okay, then hopefully, you know, if one person can relate to this and know that if I've survived it, then hopefully they can.
Yeah.
And that would be a really good thing.
Mm. It was like, you know, when you came in today and you said that, oh, you're not quite sure why you're here to talk today.
Yeah.
But actually, I think it's precisely that is why it's important.
Yeah.
Because a lot of us, like I'm sure you, hadn't suffered a loss before.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's a complete minefield where actually no one really talks about it outside of more intimate circles.
Mm.
So for you to be experiencing it for the first time,
yeah,
by yourself and for yourself must be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, no, it was.
Can you just like tell me where you were in your F1 Y1 year at the time when Tej passed away?
Yeah, so basically I had literally just got my results. It was in June, so I went to Southampton.
Of med school?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went to Southampton Medical School and I had got my results. Absolutely over the moon, as you are. You're like, oh, I finally have done this.
All those years.
Yeah, exactly. It was literally the best day of my life.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Was the sun out or?
Yes. And we were in a beer garden. I was with Tej. I was with my two sisters.
No way.
Yeah, we were all celebrating.
Oh, you've got two sisters.
Yes.
Okay.
I do. I do.
So do I.
Yeah. Then I've got a younger brother as well.
Okay.
Poor brother. And then literally 14 days after, I was actually in Tesco. You know, in the cafe in Tesco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were.
My random.
Yeah, I know. I'm a classy gal. My sister and I, we were planning my other sister's hen party.
Okay.
Because we were going to go away to Greece, and she suddenly received a phone call. And in that phone call, I just saw her face drop, and she was told that her husband, my brother-in-law Tej, had been in a car accident and was taken to a London trauma centre. So she put the phone down, and I, you know, and she told me this, and I just said to her, oh, don't worry, he's probably broken a leg, it's fine.
Mm.
Because you never think it's going to happen to you.
Of course not.
Even though we experience it every day with our patients,
you
know, I think I'm superwoman.
Mm.
I don't feel that things happen to us because we are that doctor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I said to her, look, don't worry, it's fine. You know, he's broken something. It will be okay. So we were in the car, driving to the hospital.
How was the journey there?
Absolutely horrible. My sister was driving and she was so nervous. And I just tried to be a calming effect on her. You know, I said to her, look, it will be okay. Don't worry. I'm the only medic in the family.
Yeah.
So everyone kind of turns to me when there's a medical issue or something. You know, you can't get away from going to a party and then your aunt kind of shows you something like a lesion on her butt or something. And so I just tried to calm her down and she was okay. Mm. And I myself just literally thought it was something little. And I thought, you know what? Let me just call the hospital because Tej wasn't answering his phone.
Okay.
So I called Resus because I thought, let me start off with the worst case scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that way I can just be reassured that this is nothing. So I called Resus at the London Trauma Hospital, and the consultant who had dealt with Tej's trauma happened coincidentally answered the phone. And I said to him, my relative has been brought into A&E and was in a car accident. Can you tell me how he is? And
he said,
yeah. And he said, look, I can't tell you a lot of information, but we have had a young male come in who has been in a serious car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, for the first time, played the doctor card. So I said, I'm a doctor, which was literally the first time I had said it.
Can you imagine?
Because I had just qualified literally two weeks
ago. And it's your family member. You want to...
Yeah. Yeah.
You need to be there for
them. Yeah, exactly. And I had my doctor hat on and I said, you know, I'm a doctor. It's okay. Like, tell me what's happened. And he said, we've had a young male in who's had serious life-threatening injuries and he's now in theatre and they are removing his lung.
Wow.
Yeah. And I just was like, okay. And I then asked him, what were his observations?
Oh my God.
Because I had my doctor hat on and I just thought, let me, you know, that's just a question I would ask. And then he told me and I said, okay, all right. Well, you know, we are on our way, so we'll see you there. Put the phone down. My sister's still driving. I turned to her and I did not know what to say.
Yeah.
She said, you know, what's happened? And I said, don't worry, Tej has been hurt in the accident, but it's okay. You know, they're
doing something.
Yeah, they're just doing some surgery on him, but it will be fine. And she said, you know, I heard that something about the lung. And I said, oh, no, because I just wanted my sister to be safe whilst driving.
No, of course. Bless you.
Yeah, then when we got there, I kind of told her, and that was really, really difficult. And that weight.
Did you process it yourself?
I processed it after. So outside of the cardiothoracic intensive care unit, that weight was absolutely horrible.
Mm.
And he managed to get through it, and he went to intensive care. I still had my doctor hat on in front of all my family because I felt that I had to play that role, you know, to be the communicator between the medical team and my family who are non-medics and don't really understand this whole hospital process.
Yeah.
And then after, when things kind of quietened down and he was settled in the intensive care unit, I called my best friend, walked away, and in the corridor, I literally just broke down. I said, oh my God, he's had a pneumonectomy. He's going to die. Mm. And then it's only then it kind of all settled in. Because, you know, you come across cases in the hospital and you're like, oh, this person's not going to survive.
Mm.
Like, you kind of know it, even though you throw everything at them. And you really hold on to that 1% that they will make it through.
Mm-hmm.
And that being my brother-in-law, who was literally my brother, was really difficult, really, really difficult. So, yeah. So he stayed in intensive care for 6 months. He needed something called ECMO, which is basically, for those who don't know, it's like a machine which does the work of your lungs. So it will provide oxygen to your blood and remove the carbon dioxide. And then we were told, like literally at the end of the first few weeks, that look, the only way he will survive is by having a lung transplant. That is the only hope that he has. And 6 months he was in intensive care for.
Wow.
Yeah, and then and I had started F1. And then luckily,
that would have been a few months later.
Yeah, exactly. So this accident happened in June, and then in November is when we got the call that he had a lung. But unfortunately, during his lung transplant, there was a complication. And he died during it. That was really difficult.
Yeah, that must have been life-changing for the family.
100%, 100%. It was life-changing from day one because we hadn't been through anything like this. We didn't know anyone else who had been through a car accident and you never think it's going to happen to you.
No.
Never.
And I remember doing some reading this week on just like grief and the process. I was also like looking at the differences between those who suffer losses immediately and those who suffer losses with people who've had like terminal conditions and actually just the way your mind processes things initially is so incredibly different.
Yeah,
and you guys must have experienced that quite early on.
Yeah, no, definitely. Him being in intensive care for those 6 months gave us a chance to communicate with him because he was able to talk to us. We could communicate.
Amazing.
It was like he was normal, but obviously not, because he was on all these machines and couldn't do things. But we had that chance with him, that time with him, knowing that he was critically ill.
Yeah.
And it's so different, as you say, compared to, you know, suddenly one day someone just drops dead like that. It is, because you don't have your chance to say goodbye. And I think that's where the intensive care setting is really nice.
Yeah.
Because it provides a time for families to say bye to their loved ones. And that is something that they will never be able to get back and can provide some reassurance for them. And I see it every day, you know, being in intensive care.
Of course you must. And did you know all that time that you were saying goodbye, or were you kind of taking every day as it comes when you look back?
Yeah. Do you know what? That's a really interesting question, because when you're a medic, you have so much more insight compared to non-medics. Mm-hmm. So I remember like a week into Tej's stay, where my family were like, oh, he'll be out next week. And I'm just there like, guys, I don't even think he is going to survive, let alone be out by Christmas. And it was the summer.
Did you communicate that to them, or
I communicated. Yeah, I did, because I didn't want their expectations to be
shattered.
Yeah. Mm. Or just unreal. So I said to them, look, guys, this is going to be a really long process. And we're probably looking to Christmas. Did I say that there's a high chance of mortality? No, I didn't. Mm. But that's because probably I felt it difficult to say myself.
Yeah, of course.
And you are definitely, one minute I have my doctor's hat on, and then the next minute I have my sister hat.
Yeah, that's your brother. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And that was really, really, really difficult. Mm. Really difficult.
Wow. That's a story, you know? And so, over this period of time, you're also playing doctor in real life.
yes. So, yeah, I forgot about that bit. So,
so tell me what jobs you were doing or
I started off doing a surgical job where I was mainly doing urology. And I remember when we got the phone call that there was a lung available, I was on call surgery. And we got that phone call in the morning, and I said to myself,
oh, I would have just wanted to leave.
Yeah, I really wanted to, but you feel like you've got a duty because you feel guilty if you leave. If I leave, who's going to be clerking the patients in A&E? You know, who's going to be that extra pair of hands on the wards for those discharge summaries and whatever, if they need to call me into theatre? And I think a lot of the time as doctors, we put other people in front of ourselves all the time. Mm-hmm. And By the time I got to him, unfortunately, he had died, and I didn't get to say my last goodbye. And anything that what I have taken from that is I need to put myself first.
Mm.
So if there is ever another situation like this that I will come across in my own life, I know that I need to drop my work, and instead of putting other people. I need to put myself and my family first. And that was something that was really difficult to understand, but I think it's something really important as well. Because there's no point in helping other people if you can't even help your own family and yourself.
No, sure. But then also, conversely, it's also quite difficult to do that, being probably the most junior person on your team at the time.
Yeah.
And had you spoken to anyone that day to let them know? Because I'm sure that if that was you being the senior, only knowing you for less than an hour now, I know that you would have told that junior to drop everything.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we're going to sort everything out.
Yeah.
What was a response or support for you in that day?
You know what? It's really funny that you say this, because I didn't actually tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone at work. And I think I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed that this was happening, in the sense that I had a family member who was critically ill, and that I was going through a really hard time, and I didn't want to communicate that with my team. You know, they just saw me as the happy Jacintha who comes into work, gets on with her job, you know, cracks jokes. They didn't see me as the one that when she left work, she would then be going into central London to then another hospital to then camp literally till midnight by an intensive care bed. Yeah, and I think if I could tell my F1 self again, it would be definitely to be open, share what you're going through so that you can have that support at work.
Yeah.
And I guess that is something why I feel that we do need to be talking about this.
Yeah. And I suppose it's also difficult to know who to speak to as well sometimes at work.
Yeah.
Did you have any support systems that you were able to like build into your workplace at the time, like be it friends or colleagues or educational supervisor? Was there anyone that would stand out that was supportive or listening ear for you?
So I spoke to my registrar about it at the time, because it's going to sound really silly. I received a text from Tej, and he left me a voice note.
Okay.
And the fact that he had a tracheostomy and was talking, and it was the first time I had heard his voice in like 2 months.
That's wild.
Because we had been lip reading. So I was lip reading him. Okay. So that's the way we communicated.
Okay.
And then finally just hearing his voice, and I played it on the ward, and I just burst into tears.
Oh my
gosh. I was so happy just to hear from him. And it was the best moment ever. And my reg was standing next to me. I was like, what is going on? And I just shouted. I was like, Ted just spoke to me.
And he's like, huh?
And I said, he's got a trackie and he just talked. He said he wanted a Nando's.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
So I spoke to him about it. And I guess that was good because I think talking is a really good thing and you get to offload a little bit. But in terms of, did I talk about it with my supervisors? No, mm-hmm. I didn't. And, you know, I really should have,
You know, almost when you're like looking through a booklet and it's like, okay, what's an educational supervisor there for? Then you're like reading through all the rubbish stuff and then you come and then it, and like probably in big bold letters, it's probably anything traumatic that's going on with you. Because that's real trauma for you guys to be dealing with such a heavy burden. Not to call Ted or his experience a burden.
Yeah.
But it is a lot to deal with emotionally.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it was a burden.
Yeah.
Because no one wants that stress of having a loved one in an intensive care unit, knowing that every day that's probably the last time you'll see them, or knowing that you just have to wait for an organ so that they can be alive. You know, and seeing my sister.
It sounds like a movie, you know. Like a really dramatic movie script, honestly.
You know, I wish it was a movie and not real. You know, there were days where all I wanted to do was just close my eyes and sleep and just not open them, because I knew when I would open my eyes, it would be back to reality.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but I've got through it. Yeah. And that is the main message that I want to send to people.
Okay.
If
I ask you, so after he died, intensive care, how did you process your grief? And was there like a certain role that you took on with your family?
My main concern was my sister. I literally just wanted to wrap her in cotton wool and protect her so much. And I played that role of protector and the one with the doctor's hat. And, you know, I was a communicator to her friends. I was the one who sent the messages out being like, unfortunately, Tej has died. So I played that role. So did I process it myself? No, I didn't. Did I avoid it? Yeah, I suppressed it. I went to work. I even had an intensive care job myself as an F1.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, okay. At the end of F1, I did ITU. And I don't know how I did it.
Yeah, I'm actually just sitting here confused.
I look back and think to myself, how the hell did I go into that intensive care unit? And I didn't even tell anyone. And I think I had just survived by putting it in a box and putting it away. And it was only later, I would say in like the last 2 years, that through things like counselling and talking about it, have I actually processed my own emotions and got through it. You know, I've seen my sister who's come so far, so far in how she's dealt with her grief and her loss. And I look at that with admiration. And I then say to myself, you know what? Even though he wasn't my husband, we are all affected by loss, whether it's our patient, whether it's our neighbour, whether it's our family. And we also need to process it.
And so you told me that you were in ITU and then initially I think you were doing surgery. But then was there anything that ever like triggered you when you were at work to kind of break you out of your like practical doctor hat on to Cynthia? Was anything that triggered you in any of those conversations?
Yeah, no. And even now when I get the young patient come in and I see the family all by the bedside just crying and literally holding into that hope, it reminds me of Tej and what we went through, because you empathize so much. And something that I've learned through counseling is what empathy is. And we describe it as, the way that I see empathy is, imagine you're trying on a suit for size. You're not wearing it. You're just seeing if it fits, but you're going to give it back to that person.
Okay.
That is the way that I deal with empathy now, in the sense that when I break bad news to family, when I tell them that their loved one has died in the unit, I'm trying on their suit for size and I'm feeling what they're feeling, but I know I'm going to give it back to them and then move on. Yeah, and that's something that I've learned.
Okay, and so practically when you are giving that bad news, how do you go about it?
Yeah, so
one thing that I've learned is that it's really important to use the D word, which is death, because we are always using the word loss or pass away. You know, you lose your grandma in Tesco, you don't, they're not lost kind of thing. And we need to, I feel like we need to stop using euphemisms because it doesn't really get through to them. I know when I was in that position of being that patient relative, the intensivist and anaesthetist said to us, said the sentence, Tej has died. And that resonated with us so much compared to if they say, you know, I'm sorry, he's passed away. And I see it with my own with my own patients. You need to be really honest with them. And even experiences with my friend, she's recently lost her aunt. She said, all I wanted was clarification. We just wanted to be told that she was dying, but they never used that word. It was always, oh, you know, we'll see how she goes. Oh, okay, so I think we're going to stop the chemotherapy now. No one actually said, she will die. This is, we are approaching the end of her life now. And I think honesty is something which patients really appreciate. And I've had feedback myself from relatives, and they say, thank you for being so honest with us, because they really do appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't need to mollycoddle them as a doctor who's only met their family member once. They just need that clarification, don't they? And that reminds me of one time when I was in recess, because I work in A&E mostly as a locum. But in my recess, we had a family come in, and the gentleman, he had advanced dementia. And he wasn't eating very much, and he was just kind of declining and deteriorating quite slowly over a long period of time. And essentially, I remember there was two family members, one brother and one sister. I remember just talking to the brother, and I just realised how, initially I thought he was in denial, but then later I came to realise that actually he's now met lots of different doctors along this 5-year journey of decline, and no one has ever used the word death or dying with him. And so it wasn't denial that I was like coming up to face with him, it was actually just lack of awareness of where his father was at this time. And the sister, I remember she came up to me afterwards and she said, thank you for being so clear with us. This is what I thought was happening. But everyone in my family is talking about it like he's going to get better. But there's no getting better from a terminal condition like that. So just hearing you say that, that's important for me as a clinician to take forward with me. So it is interesting how we try and protect our patients.
But also, do you think there's an aspect of trying to protect ourselves as doctors? We don't like the aspect of knowing that we failed, that we can't save that patient. We don't.
It's also uncomfortable. Like, on a practical note,
100%. 100% is uncomfortable.
Because when you use the word taboo, when we were talking about it just before this episode, I was like, yeah, this is something that we're not protected from society. We're also people who live in society. So, of course, we're going to share the same taboo. So actually, we need to recognise those taboos that we probably are afraid to, like, go into those conversations and kind of force ourselves to be clearer with our words.
But I think also there's a taboo amongst us as well.
In what way?
In the sense that if you're affected by a patient's loss, you know, because you may get to know your patient really well. I know in the intensive care unit, I see them every day. I meet their relatives every day. Sometimes they have really long stays, just like Tej, for 6 months. His medical team and his nurses became our family. You know, they came to his funeral. They, I'm still in contact with them now. They were our family. They were our hope. And so you may go home and be affected. You may cry. You may let it out. But we need to talk about it amongst ourselves. I remember a case, and it, you know, it was really sad, and you know, it was a long-term marriage, 35 years, and she died on their anniversary. And the next day, my registrar came in and said, oh, I was really upset yesterday. And I turned around to her and said, so was I. And we literally spent about 20 minutes just talking about how we felt about it. And yet, we don't do that enough.
We don't
debrief enough, and because it is a taboo.
I thought you were going to tell me that you guys are really good at debriefing.
So we are, in the sense that if it's after a cardiac arrest, we always have a debrief after, and especially like when I lead them as well, because sometimes I've got student nurses. Sometimes I've got student nurses, so I go through, you know, what we could have done better, how can we move forward, if there were any concerns. But I mean, that's all very formal.
Yeah.
How did you feel on a personal level?
Mm-hmm.
Let's have an informal chat about that, mm-hmm. you know, just with one-to-one or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was actually a study amongst oncologists. I think it was done in the US. And they found that majority of them felt ashamed, mm-hmm. felt embarrassed, felt that they weren't. It was a sign of weakness to be upset of the fact that their patients had died and that they were embarrassed of experiencing grief as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think that is definitely a taboo amongst us as doctors and we really need to break it through.
Mm.
And it's not weakness. It just shows, you know, it's what? You're human.
Yeah.
You are human. And if anything, you can then relate to your patients so much better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because the patients do appreciate people who can talk to them on a level
exactly.
and understand what they're going through.
Exactly.
And rather than someone who's just so focused on being so resilient that mm. actually they just like lose all human connection. Yeah.
And that was me. Mm. I thought it was weakness.
Yeah. That's how we're trained, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And then slowly what's happened over the years, because this happened in 2014
mm.
and then my dad died in 2015, I just felt that my bucket was being emptied and emptied and emptied mm. until there was nothing.
Yeah.
And then you've got the extra pressures of exams, mm. you know, the night shifts, the weekends, your own personal relationships.
Yeah. And so with that analogy that you used of the bucket being emptied, can you talk us about the journey until your father?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Passed away.
Yeah, so I was an F2. I was working in the Royal London at the time, which is in East London.
So you went
London.
Back to the same hospital?
So Tej didn't die in the Royal London.
Okay.
He was based in West London.
I see.
He was actually in George's.
Okay.
No, I didn't work there. But so I was really into pre-hospital medicine before this had happened, hence why I had applied for F1 and F2 in London.
I
wanted the Royal London. Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
You little geek.
I know. I'm so sad. I didn't go where, you know, my non-existent boyfriend was. I went where I thought I could do the whole pre-hospital.
I like it.
So I was on A&E and I absolutely loved it. But then again, I was seeing trauma every single day. And every day I was reminded of the situation of Tej, and that led to my own anxieties as well, which counselling really helped because I was scared of driving.
Yeah. And when did you seek counselling?
So I'm really lucky in that my family's really open.
Mm-hmm.
And my mum said to me, you need to get counselling, whether it's through work or something like that, you need to do it because mm-hmm. it is so helpful. And members of my family had it,
But I just felt like, no, I don't need this. You know, the gym is sorting me out, because that was the way that I dealt with things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But actually it was the counseling that really helped, because I couldn't drive anymore because mm-hmm. I was scared that I would die. And that was just positively reinforced yeah. by being in a trauma center doing A&E every yeah. day. Mm-hmm. So anyway, going back to my dad, I was on nights and I was sleeping during the day, and it was the afternoon, woke up, saw all these missed calls. From my mum, called her, she didn't answer her phone, called my aunt, and my aunt answered and said, your mum's found dad collapse and had to do CPR, and the ambulance are now there resuscitating him. And I just, my heart sank, I cried, and I said, oh my God, dad's died. And my aunt said to me, what are you on about, Jacintha? Like, it's fine. They're resuscitating him. It will be okay. And I'm like, no, auntie, it is not okay. When this happens, you know, there's a 5% chance of out of hospital cardiac arrest surviving. But obviously, being the only medic, you only understand that, because non-medics, all they watch is Holby City and casualty. And they see, you know, some chest compressions and then the person is drinking a cup of tea the next day, you know. And that doesn't happen because that is not reality. And that's why maybe when we have DNR conversations, families have a certain point of view, because they are only seeing what the media portrays, which is so incorrect. But anyway, so and then my aunt was like, what? And then she started crying, and then I went home.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you were by yourself at the time when you saw the missed calls?
Yeah, so I had flatmates. I had other F2s that I was living with, and they were really helpful. Mm. I told them what happened, and then I just got a taxi back home. And I called my best friend, who just dropped. She was working in a local hospital. She was in her clinic, and she just left her clinic and actually saw my dad before I did. So because you always feel like things aren't being done properly.
Yeah.
And I just wanted someone there to make sure it's okay. Because every day we see things that go wrong or like little mishaps. And I just wanted it to all be okay.
Yeah.
So I spoke to the ambulance team on the phone, and they said, like, look, we've done 9 cycles now. I think we need to stop. And I said to him, you know what? That's absolutely fine. And the reason being is because this is crazy. Literally 4 months before, I had sat my family down around a table and I had shown them a video of what CPR actually was. And we went through what we would want
and
our end of life decisions.
No, you didn't.
I swear we did that. I swear. And the reason I did that with my family,
I feel like I need to process that. That's actually mad, but amazing as
well. Yeah. And the reason I did that was because I didn't want to be a hypocrite, because I felt so frustrated having conversations with families and their relatives, because I could see the stress on their shoulders, that they were like, oh, I don't know what my husband would have wanted. Oh, I don't know what my family would have wanted. And you just saw the stress on their shoulders trying to make this decision of resuscitation, end of life wishes, whether they would want all these tubes and things like that. And I felt this process can be made so much easier if we just spoke to our family about it, you know, over a cup of tea. It doesn't have to be
a high stress situation.
It doesn't have to be a sad discussion. It should, why is it we talk about birth and we talk about things like that, but yet something which is so important that we will
one
all
of the
experience,
most important things.
And something where you want to be able to have dignity when you die. And it's a conversation that you can have with your loved ones, and it can just make things so much easier. And I compare it to when I have organ donation conversations. The families who have had that conversation, they are the ones who bring up organ donation first. They are the ones who are like, you just see the weight off their shoulders compared to the ones that haven't. And that's really sad to see. So I sat everyone down around the table and I thought, you know what, I'm going to show them what CPR actually is, because it's not like what you see on casualty. It's really harsh. And my dad said, you know what, I actually don't want to be resuscitated. And that was something.
Do you remember that quite clearly?
really clearly because my siblings, my two sisters and my brother, were shocked that he said that because they were like, what? You don't want to be resuscitated? Why not? Like, Dad. But I could understand where my dad was coming from because we've got that medical perspective.
Yeah.
You know, we see the elderly patients who are slowly deteriorating and dying.
Mm-hmm.
So when I spoke to the ambulance over the phone, I didn't feel guilty.
Mm.
I felt like, you know what? I've had this conversation with my dad. I know what he would have wanted.
Mm.
It's okay.
Mm.
It's okay.
What a fun conversation to have, though, over the phone.
Yeah. And I think I had my medical hat on.
Yeah.
100%.
Okay. There's some situations you just have to. You have to, like, have all the avoidance in your eyes because
I know.
That's just too much to deal with all of a sudden.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. But it can be a negative as well. And I think it definitely was a negative because I was having my medical hat on all the time and I wasn't dealing with issues until I actually sat down and spoke about it through counselling.
I was just going to ask you that, actually. At what point was it when you were like, look, you need to deal with this and talk about it rather than just playing doctor all the time?
So I think when I felt my bucket was empty and I had nothing else to give. I had nothing else to give to work. I had nothing else to give to my patients. And I had nothing else to give to myself. That's when I was like, you know what? I actually do need help here.
Yeah.
And then I went on to, you know what? There's actually not a lot of resources for doctors and bereavement. And it was really difficult to find out.
Were you looking for something specific for doctors or?
Yeah, I was because I thought, why is there nothing for doctors and nurses that that we can have counselling for? Why is it not spoken about? Like, I don't know with you and at work, if a consultant or senior has ever said to you, oh, you know, there are counselling services out there whenever you come across a trauma or anything like that.
Actually, it's weird you ask that because I've only ever had one person ever do that, and that's just because I've got I did an elderly medicine job as my last F2 job.
Yeah,
so that's a very different environment, first of all, and the mindset is very different. Also, my consultant, he's been a consultant for absolutely years and educational supervisors for like decades essentially. So before
really
you
good.
Join him, he'll send you this email and it'll list all the different counseling services, all the different places that you can reach out for like free support and also like paid support. And that's before he even gets to know you. So
that's amazing.
That
is absolutely amazing.
But the thing, and it's just like you're saying, you can't wait until something happens.
Yeah.
You have to anticipate. You have to anticipate these scenarios beforehand.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's just so amazing that you guys, as a family, were able to be so open, because not everyone is open with their families.
No, definitely.
And sit down and have a conversation about what does the end of your life look like.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Because it's not an easy thing to bring up.
No, it's not.
It isn't.
But having it over a cup of tea and cake is all right.
It's better.
exactly.
No, bless you guys. And can I ask, with the journey of grief, because you've experienced it so much and so closely with your family, do you feel like you made that journey as a family, or do you feel like you made that journey like on an individual level?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think we've made it as a family. But so imagine like a roller coaster.
She's doing a lot of explanation with her hands at the moment. I'm like, verbalize.
Yeah. I'm gonna break out into a dance scene. So imagine being on a roller coaster and you've got a carriage. So I felt that my family were in the couple of carriages ahead.
Okay.
And then I was the one behind. So I was kind of lagging a bit.
Okay.
And that's because I think I had counselling a lot later than what my sister had. And also it was that feeling of protection for my family. So I wanted to look after them first. Yeah. I want to look after my sister. I want to look after my mum. And then I thought, okay, I need to look after myself. And that's something as doctors that we don't do very well.
It's probably part of your like makeup, wanting to help other people in your career, but also being that position in your family and also being a doctor in your family.
Yeah,
it can't have helped.
No, definitely. And as I said before, I think that I'm superwoman sometimes. You know, I feel like I can get through anything. And we learn about, you know, one in four medics and doctors will experience a mental health concern during their lifetime. you never think that you're actually going to be that statistic until something happens to you. But you know what? That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. And it's also okay to not be okay.
Yeah.
That's something I've realised as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if anything was to happen like this, hopefully it doesn't, but if anything so traumatic was to happen again, what tools do you think you have now that would help you deal with various situations in the future? Or how would you like support your juniors in dealing with such
events? I would definitely want them to be open to me about it. So I want them to talk to me because that's something that I didn't really feel that I could do. So I would strongly suggest if anyone is going through bereavement or grief at work, whether mm-hmm. that be a loved one or a patient, inform work how you're feeling,
mm-hmm.
whether that be a senior or your educational supervisor, as you mm-hmm. said. You know, it was so great that he sent out those resources. And we shouldn't feel embarrassed. We shouldn't feel ashamed because mm-hmm. we are all normal. And you'll be surprised because when you talk to a colleague, mm-hmm. they will then open up to you and say, oh, you know what, I was also experiencing
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm. And it literally blows my mind when I realise that like my colleagues have like real human events
and
going on in life.
Especially when they're seniors as well. I still get, you know, a bit blown away when I see a consultant cry or a bit upset. I'm like, oh, okay. They are also human.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely inform work. I would say in terms of coping with grief, find your outlet. So for me, that was the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Big up Gymbox in Stratford. But it literally saved my life.
I feel like that opened not too long ago.
It opened up in 2014.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you're one of the founder members.
unfortunately, I'm not a member of it anymore. But it literally did save my life. I met people there. We used to train like 4 or 5 times a week. They became my family.
Mm.
We spoke to each other about what we were going through and we took it out on the weights.
Yeah.
We threw the weights around.
Mm.
That's how we released mm-hmm, our mm-hmm. anger and my stress.
Yeah.
And it was weird because I found the heavier the weight I lifted, the stronger I felt
mm-hmm,
and the stronger I became mm-hmm. meant that my guard was...
And we're talking mentally as well, aren't we?
Yeah. And the heavier the weight I go, the stronger then I would feel, the stronger I feel, the stronger I am and the more resilient I am.
Mm.
However, I've learned that that can only last you so long.
Yeah.
Because then you've got to sort your mind out.
Yeah, totally.
And then that's when the counselling then came into play. But, you know, find your outlet, whether mm-hmm. that's painting or poetry or mm-hmm. writing or just spending time with family and friends. Mm-hmm. Like, just do the things.
So let's talk about your counselling. So how did you find it? Like, how did you literally find where to go?
Yeah. So as I said, it was really difficult. And I went online. I Googled, actually, counselling for doctors and not a lot came up, just all these kind of papers, but nothing, like no resources.
What, like medical papers?
Yeah. Like, no.
Here's a study on how people have suffered losses in their life.
So I went on to the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy, the BACP website,
mm-hmm.
and they're really good because they've got a list of registered counsellors that you can go to, and they specialise in different things. So I wanted a counsellor who was more trained for bereavement.
Okay.
So I went for that. And then you're not going to click with a counsellor straight away.
Yeah, I was going to say, because there's people I just don't click with.
Yeah, so I went to see this one lady, didn't really click with her, went to see another one, didn't click with her. And I was like, I remember saying to my sister, look, I can't do this. She was like, try again. And I tried and I finally found someone who just understood me. Mm-hmm. And honestly...
Amazing.
Counselling is literally... the gym for the mind. It is so good. So I definitely recommend that.
And can I ask, in counselling, what was it that really was beneficial for you? Because I like read so much about counselling and I've never actually done it myself, but when I look, I see that people get released from conversations. They also get insights into the way that they behave.
Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that shocked you about counselling or made you think, oh no, this is what I needed?
I felt guilty talking to friends and family.
Did you?
Yeah, because I didn't want to offload my burden onto them, especially my family. Like, why do I want to tell my sister what I'm going through when she is going through something 10 times worse, having lost her husband? Mm. Why do I want to tell my mum that I'm upset when she's also lost her husband?
Mm-mm.
You know, why did I want to do that? You know, why do I want to talk to my friends about it all the time? So I felt seeing a counsellor, seeing someone unbiased,
mm-hmm.
meant that I didn't feel guilty offloading to them. And I made each session really useful.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that is good.
I think that was the main thing.
But you made each session useful.
Yeah, in the sense that I knew I had 1 hour to sit down and talk about something. And I didn't feel guilty doing it.
Totally. No, I feel you. I feel you.
Because they were someone I didn't really know. Sometimes it's easier to speak to a stranger than it is to speak to another one.
Yeah, like that judgment is gone as well.
Yeah.
And I know that even you were mentioning today some like groups that you can find online.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in the media very recently, particularly like with, I know there was a documentary on the BBC earlier last week.
Yeah.
And I can't remember his name, George something or
George
other.
Shelley.
Yeah, George Shelley.
Yeah, that documentary was amazing.
Mate, it was so great.
Really, really good. I watched it a couple of days ago, actually. Yeah. And he's so brave to talk about losing his sister and the way that he's dealt with it, especially being a young male. And we know male mental health is really topical at the moment, especially with suicide being the highest cause of death in young males. So, yeah, it's really brave and courageous what he's done.
Yeah, and I thought it was so amazing that when he attended, so there's this one part of the show when he attends this group and it's all about people who've lost their siblings.
Yeah.
And they all just sit down and just talk about their siblings.
Yes.
And I remember the girl, she said something and it really stuck with me. And she said, I found it really difficult to say my sibling's name.
Yeah.
And I remember when the first time that I ever experienced like such a close loss, my friend died. Her name's Doyen, by the way. And she died the day I was doing my OSCE exam. So I finished my OSCE exam. I found out that she had died like later on that evening. Yeah. And then I had my written exams, which I actually failed and had to resit.
Man, that must have been so difficult.
But it was like, you know, when you're like, oh, I can deal with failing an exam.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even care because biggest loss is her life here.
Put it into perspective,
it totally puts stuff into perspective. I remember finding it really difficult to say her name. And I realized that when I bumped into her little sister at a wedding earlier this year, so this is like 2 years down the line, and I was like, oh my gosh, you look so much like, and I could not say her name. And then I went and watched that documentary and I was like, wow, it's very powerful to be able to say the name of the person that you lost.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So,
that is something in my family that we always try and do. So we still talk about Tej. But I get you because I really miss saying dad.
Yeah.
When I go home, sometimes it's going to sound really weird. Sometimes I actually just say, dad, do you want a cup of tea? Because I always used to say that and I miss saying that. Mm. So I'll just talk to myself and say out loud, dad, do you want a cup of tea? Mm. And because that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
So if you want to say something, then just say it. Yeah. Like, don't feel silly.
Yeah. Because it allows that person to continue to live on, doesn't it? Especially when they've had such an impact on your life.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Just want to, like, also talking about, you know, we mentioned vision boards earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do ever feel lost and a bit off the rails, because when I experienced the losses, I kind of felt, you know, where am I going with my life? You know, work's already stressed. You've got the exams. I felt writing it down and creating a vision board of what I wanted to achieve in the separate aspects of my life really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, for work, I had, you know, try and get into anesthetics, pass my ATLS.
And what does that look like?
Yeah. Survive the year. you know, I had travel. I wanted to go to St. Lucia.
Mm-hmm.
I had a section on charity on my vision board. Mm-hmm. I wanted to donate blood because I hadn't done that until I was an F2.
Oh.
And I felt like that was really important.
And where did you put this vision board? Was it something
on my wall? So as soon as I woke up, I would see this big piece of paper on my wall and it had just everything that I wanted to achieve. And it kind of made me have focus in my life again when everything around me was breaking down.
And it's also these reminders that you can just see without having to make too much effort.
Yeah.
Because I know similar people who would do the same thing and write it in a diary.
Yeah.
But the second your diary is closed, that's the second that you're not able to go back and look on what your goals are.
So out of pace, out of mind.
Completely. Mm-hmm. And the way we work as human beings is just to kind of focus on our short-term goals.
Yeah.
So until you put those long-term goals up and know the ways that you get them, I think actually it's a really, really, really powerful method.
It creates hope as well. And you can turn something negative into a positive. Mm-hmm. Like I did Tough Mudder, I did the half marathon, and I raised money for KSS Air Ambulance because that's, they saved Tej.
Yeah.
So it made a positive out of the negative.
Yeah. And can I ask, in that F1, F2 year, just because that was the times in which you, these people died.
Yeah.
What were your like overriding emotions at that time? Do you feel like your emotions changed a lot, or do you feel like you had anger, hope, sadness? What did you feel like during those times?
You know, going back to that roller coaster analogy, that's exactly how it is. Healing is not linear. Grief is not linear. One day you will feel absolutely fine and you go through the five stages of grief. Your denial, your anger, your depression, and I can't remember the others. You will go through that. And just when you feel like you're okay.
Like, oh, I'm sorted.
Yeah.
Sorted, mate.
But trust me, you go to Tesco and you see something and you burst into tears. But that's normal. That is normal. You know, I went into Tesco last month. I saw a bottle of ketchup and I cried because it reminded me of Tej, because my sister had an argument with him over ketchup one day. But you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. And I get text messages from friends saying, oh, you know, I've just cried about this. And it's like, healing is not linear and it's okay to not be okay.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. I'm going to like keep that phrase in my mind. It's okay not to be okay.
No, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so Jacintha, we started off this, well, I started off this episode with a little bit of a spiel about you. And we've talked about loss, we've talked about grief, but what we haven't talked about as much is organ donation.
Yeah.
So tell everyone a little bit about organ donation and also what you're trying to achieve with it.
Yeah, sure. So with organ donation, as you know, there is a register that we currently have.
Is it opt-in, opt-out at the moment? What
so
is it?
So it's currently opt-in, but in 2020, I think it's going to move to opt-out. It's not set, but that is what the government are aiming towards.
And how do you feel about that?
I think it's a positive.
Yes, I do. I just want to say. Just wanted to clarify.
Definitely think it's a positive. But most importantly, what I, you know, it's not even about people registering.
Yeah.
All I want people to do is have that conversation.
Mate, yeah.
Or not even have that conversation. Research what it's about or talk about what it's about.
Yeah.
Bounce
or what
each
it
other
means
off.
For you specifically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And have that conversation with your loved ones. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to break that taboo of organ donation, especially amongst the Black and Asian ethnic minorities. 30% of BAME community are on the organ donation list, you know, and we make up 11% of the UK population. So there's definitely a discrepancy here. There is a longer wait for the BAME community compared to the white population, just due to, you know, blood types and so forth, waiting for an organ. And I feel that's because we are not having these conversations. It's a taboo. It's something that we can't talk about. So I'm really trying to break through that. And the more we talk, then the less a taboo it will become. And then hopefully if people want to donate, then they can register onto it.
Yeah. And I think even like we were saying earlier on, it's really important for family members of people who are in the process of dying or coming towards the end of the life of their life to understand what their family members want. Because actually a lot of the time, even the reasons people say no to DNA CPR or no to wanting to donate their family members' organs is because they don't want to like disrespect their family member in any way.
Exactly.
They just all everyone is trying to do is protect family members at this point.
Definitely. But also remember that even if you are on the register, your family can still refuse for you to donate. And that is something not a lot of people know about. Because we would never go against relatives.
No.
So if a patient is on the register but their family don't want them to donate, then we would obviously go with the family. But that's why if you are on the register, if you do want to donate, you need to tell your loved ones about it and share what you want.
So actually, Jacintha, I remember an intensivist came into one of our A&E teaching sessions to talk to us as A&E doctors about actually having conversations with family members who come in to resus and about organ donation. Now, something that I remember from that conversation is that he was talking about making sure you're having a very open conversation with the family.
Yeah.
And instead of just saying, hi, can we take some organs? But rather say, okay, as part of this process, what we would like to do is also have the option of donating organs to other people who may need it.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't take anything away from your family member or the care that we want to receive, but it's better to have these conversations earlier on.
Yeah.
So for doctors who aren't intensivists, what sort of advice would you give them, or what sorts of ways in your hospital are they empowered to have conversations about organ donations with patients?
Yeah, so I think it normally comes into the process of your DNR conversations, doesn't it? So when you talk about DNR, because then you're kind of talking about your end of life decisions. So it can be brought up then.
Mm.
But also just generally just having a conversation about how they feel, what they're going through. You know, I've got renal transplant patients who need a kidney, and we talk about organ donation, or just generally my patients on intensive care who aren't even at an organ donation stage. We just generally, so for example, I had someone who watched a TV program and someone died, and then they were just having a conversation about organ donation. Or it can be something so simple, they see a poster and then that conversation comes about.
Yeah.
So I don't think there is ever a right time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that's why these conversations just need to be had.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
So there's a really good charity called Live Life, Give Life that I've written and I've shared my story for. And I'm in the process of doing information leaflets for families who have a loved one in intensive care and then hopefully doctors as well, because it is something that is really big, dealing with grief. Yeah. And it's something that we all go through as well.
So, Jacintha, because we're coming to the end of the episode now, and we've spoken about a lot of things, and I know we can continue with this conversation.
Yeah. Hopefully it wasn't too depressing.
No, it was so great. And it's just an insight into what people go through.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thanks
for sliding into the DMs. So aside from your work on organ donation and, of course, all it takes to be in the anesthetic trainee.
Yeah,
I'm still struggling with the word.
Mate, so am I. And I'm one apparently.
So what's going on for you like in the coming years and before we close?
Yeah. Do you know what? That's really interesting because I've just sat the anesthetic exams. Oh my God. They are so hard.
I saw the image of you like taking down all your like material from the wall. I was like, oh my gosh, it looks like she's back in uni.
Yeah, literally. It was terrible. I had no life for like 8 months. But no, I managed to get through it somehow, somewhere. Someone got me through those exams. But I'm at a period of my life where I need to put myself first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit exhausted of nights and weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And I just need to chill out for a little bit. Yeah. I haven't had a break. I did med school, went straight into F1, F2.
Mm-hmm.
And then straight into anaesthetics.
Mm.
So,
and you also chose an area of medicine that's like not that easy to go through slowly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, anaesthetics. I'm not saying there's someone to blame here, but.
I wish I was that personality. You could just choose something
just chill.
Easy. Yeah, just chill. But you know what? I'm learning. I'm learning that I actually just need to chill now and put myself first and do things that interest me. I want to get back into yoga and the gym because movement is really my medicine.
It's so important.
Yeah, movement is my medicine and it makes me happy. And sometimes you need to go through dips to really understand what you want. So whether the future is still in anaesthetics and intensive care, hopefully, but maybe not. Maybe I might switch, but it's okay not to know.
It is.
Just take every day at a time, I guess.
Dope. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
I feel like I've made a new friend.
So am I. We're friends, mate.
We are. So guys, a lesson from
secret
today.
African sister.
There you go.
African wannabe.
Completely. So not only should you, slide into DMs, you should also remember that it's okay not to be okay. And the most important thing is just to keep talking and sharing your difficulties in life with people who you feel comfortable and able to do that with.
Yeah.
But just putting yourself as number one is important sometimes. Okay, you doctors who wear the S on your chest, it's important to take that off sometimes.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So thank you for coming.
Thank you. Honestly, it's been such a blessing. And yeah, thank you so much.
All right, cool. Everyone, take care. Bye.
Bye.
Today's episode was recorded at Mare Street Market.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersmarket.com or /afterthelettersmarket on every social media network.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.